I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, September 8th. Today, what 9/11 changed about America's place in the world. And of course, this isn't just a history lesson. The deadly and complicated withdrawal from Afghanistan makes it front and center news that raises as many questions for this country's future as it does about the past. Our guest for this is New Yorker columnist Robin Wright. She's also a distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and the author of many books on world affairs, including notably for this conversation, Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World, which was framed in part around the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. It came out around back then. One of her recent New Yorker articles is called, "Does the Great Retreat from Afghanistan Mark the End of an American Era?" Robin, always good to tap your vast knowledge. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. It's always great to be with you. Sad as we mark the 20th anniversary.
Indeed. And you write that the retreat from Afghanistan isn't just an epic defeat for the United States. The fall of Kabul may serve as a bookend for the era of U.S. global power that began way back in 1941, now ending in 2021. What's the most basic outline of the 80-year arc that you see there?
Well, we began that arc with the U.S. taking on the sophisticated Nazi war machine and the Japanese Empire. The United States proved that it was a global superpower with its vast military arsenal and its skilled Army, Navy, Air Force, and Coast Guard. 80 years later, we have retreated after a 20-year war, America's longest, $1 trillion at least just in past expenditures, the deaths of 250,000 people. We had to scurry out of Afghanistan when we faced a ragtag militia that had no air power, no significant arsenal. Only the armored vehicles were those confiscated from the Afghan army. And it had a force only 60,000 to 70,000 strong in a country that was the size of Texas. And so our retreat comes as a real blow at a lot of levels to our prestige, to our ability to prove that a great democracy with one of the world's most powerful militaries can beat people who are trying to take a country and a society back to the dark ages.
And you write that this retreat is part of an unnerving American pattern that dates back to the 1970s, and not just the retreat from Vietnam in 1975, the comparison that's being made a lot right now, but more than that, including President Reagan and President Obama. Can you describe that pattern?
Absolutely. I actually lived in Lebanon when America retreated from Beirut. The Reagan administration had deployed peacekeepers to divide the Israelis and the Palestinians who had been fighting a three-month war in Lebanon. And the United States was trying to create an alternative, you know, help broker a peace agreement, help stabilize Lebanon with implications for the whole region. And instead, after the very first suicide bomb against the military, the Marines first went kind of underground, became defensive in their deployment, and then eventually just moved to ships and sailed off. This was a peacekeeping mission, and we failed at that. And of course, in 2011, President Obama opted to withdraw from Iraq, which opened the way ultimately for the emergence of ISIS, which for the next 5 years redrew the map of the Middle East by taking huge chunks of Syria and Iraq, and it forced the United States to go back to fight yet a whole different kind of war in Iraq.
And I don't want to over-romanticize U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War period as simply defending freedom from Soviet totalitarianism. I mean, we backed dictators and other bad governments if they backed us, including being slow to split from the apartheid regime in South Africa to Mubarak in Egypt, Saddam Hussein when he was at war with Iran, and others, and of course the complex millions of deaths tragedy of Vietnam. So how does that complexity fit into these arcs that you're talking about?
Well, the world was a bipolar world, and countries basically had to take sides if they wanted to get aid or political support, diplomatic engagement with either the United States or the Soviet Union. You know, the world is divided again, but in a much more complex way. We have, whether it's the U.S.-China competition, the U.S.-Russia competition, those are the kind of old Cold War divisions. But we also have a whole array of non-state actors that have proliferated around the world. You know, when we went to war in Afghanistan, there was one Al-Qaeda group that had found a base, a safe haven in Afghanistan. Today, Al-Qaeda has six other franchises around the world. It decided that to survive, it needed to create cells that then became larger operations in other countries, on other continents. ISIS, the Islamic State for Syria and Iraq, actually now is in the same position. It has created franchises. It has a network that you can count up to 20 different types of franchises around the world. I was in Mozambique for independence in 1975. This is a country in southern Africa with a 60% Christian population. And last month, the U.S. sanctioned the ISIS branch in Mozambique. So ISIS has made headway, and a lot of these Islamic extremist movements have made headway far beyond their original borders, far from places you might ever envision, with an impact that will affect local security, regional security, and potentially the kind of threats that Americans or American interests will face for years to come.
Robin, let me play some brief sound bites of each president since 9/11 on U.S. foreign policy and get your take on the arc of rhetoric and events and the sort of pendulum, almost whiplash-like, swinging back and forth from one to the next to the next. Here's George W. Bush, just after 9/11, announcing the invasion of Afghanistan, but promising much more.
The name of today's military operation is Enduring Freedom. We defend not only our precious freedoms, but also the freedom of people everywhere to live and raise their children free from fear.
So he wasn't just rooting out Al-Qaeda to protect U.S. national security to listen to that. He was promising, quote, freedom for people everywhere. But by the end of his term, he and Vice President Cheney were widely seen as purveyors of a unilateral, you know, cowboy war in Iraq at best, and purveyors of torture to boot. One of the main reasons Barack Obama was elected over both John McCain and Hillary Clinton was for opposing that war from the start and promising this once Obama was in office.
The United States is moving forward from a position of strength. The long war in Iraq will come to an end by the end of this year. The transition in Afghanistan is moving forward, and our troops are finally coming home.
Obama in 2011 telling the world we were moving on from the Bush-Cheney war machine. He notably gave his first foreign speech in Cairo to help restore U.S. credibility in the region as he saw it. But after 8 years of Obama, Donald Trump was elected, partly on his campaign of portraying Obama and Trump's opponent Hillary Clinton as weak.
To solve a problem, you have to be able to state what the problem is, or at least say the name. She won't say the name, and President Obama won't say the name, but the name is there. It's radical Islamic terror. And before you solve it, you have to say the name.
And after 4 years of Trump leaning toward Putin and other authoritarians as the new U.S.-led alliance, Joe Biden was elected and promptly announced this.
America is back. Diplomacy is back at the center of our foreign policy.
So, Robin, I know those little sound bites are kind of reductionist, but would you agree there's been this kind of whiplash foreign policy since 9/11 of aggression and retreat, with both ways having mixed results?
Absolutely, and your selection of sound bites is truly chilling. Historians are going to have a field day with the first two decades of the 20th century. I think there are 21st century, I think there are four things that come out of this. First of all, we are often reactive. As a great power, we should be more proactive in both understanding the world and trying to use the variety of tools we have at our disposal, not just our military force. Military force will never beat an extremist ideology. Just not going to happen. And the military are among the first to understand that. I think second, the tragedy represented by Afghanistan, but also the sequence of quotes you've illustrated or chosen, is that, you know, jihadism has beaten democracy in all the arenas where we have chosen to fight. And that's pretty electrifying. Democracy, at the end of the day, is a much stronger ideology, but it is shocking to me that jihadism could win any place against democracy. The next thing is that the lessons we learned in Iraq and Afghanistan is that the United States, for all its good intentions, or despite all its wealth and skills, does not know how to effectively either build a nation or establish a military in just a decade or two. Too often, we really don't understand local societies for a variety of reasons. I had a former administration, senior administration official say to me just last week that the United States in 20 years never really understood Afghanistan. And that is profoundly true. And I can say that because I've been going there since the first round of Taliban rule in the 1990s. And I was there in March with General McKenzie, who had Central Command at a time that the Taliban had retaken half the country. We just, you know, we invested $83 million in building the Afghan army. It was four times larger than the Taliban, and yet it disappeared. The next thing that strikes me is that the U.S. has, in both of its wars, organized or mobilized global coalitions. The one for Afghanistan is the largest in human history. We had over 100 countries participating, more than almost two dozen countries allowing the U.S. to use its soil for military operations or military transit. And in Iraq, we managed to pull together a kind of meager, pathetic coalition of the willing countries that wanted to curry favor with the United States and really played only token roles. The question is, coming out of both of these wars, when will coalitions be able to be formed again by the United States, tapping into allies who, after all, many of them are democracies whose people don't want to see, you know, the loss of life, failed missions, the expenditure of national treasures, impact on the economy. How often will they want to ally themselves with, you know, dangerous missions overseas? And so I think that's weakened the United States. So I think there are a lot of long-term repercussions that come out of not just Afghanistan, but our two decades, four presidencies, of trying to deal with this phenomena.
And Robin, how do you see the 20-year legacy in terms of the U.S. as a so-called beacon of freedom for oppressed people? I mean, Bush tried to sell the war in Iraq that way. We played that clip with respect to Afghanistan, but he said the same thing leading up to the war in Iraq. This isn't just about U.S. national security. This is about leveraging freedom with a few well-placed military invasions, as he saw it, you know, because he tried to sell his wars that way, but I think it wound up mostly just discrediting the U.S. as a beacon of freedom. Biden just now pulled us from Afghanistan because there is no U.S. interest, but leaving the people of that country, as we've been discussing, back in the hands of a murderous and misogynist theocracy. Just yesterday, they announced their new male-only leadership, the Taliban, largely of the same guys from the 90s. So quite a contrast with the liberation of Europe in World War II from the Nazis, to recall your original point at the beginning of this conversation. So my question is, what are the options now, if any, for the U.S. being any kind of moral leader?
At the end of the day, the vast majority of people I've met in now more than 140 countries do want freedom. They want the ability to have a say in their life, whether it is politically, economically, socially. They want a sense of dignity and equality in some form. The question is, what is the model? What is the role model? Is the U.S. still a beacon? The United States is still the dominant power in the West, no question. But that's partly by default, because there is not a lot of leadership or the creation of alternatives, whether it is politically or even militarily. So we are still the model for the West. But I think the level of respect is in doubt. And I think there's also, to a certain degree, questions about what are U.S. intentions? Are they honorable? Are they selfish? Are they really out to help us? Or are they to better the U.S. position in the world, its influence? There have been pieces written over the past 2 weeks about the end of the American empire. It was this a period where we wanted to have a kind of quasi-colonial rule through our flunkies or allies in the countries where we have deployed? I think one of the great problems in Afghanistan was that the depth of corruption was so profound that the army at the end of the day would rather defect or disappear than fight for a democratically elected government, because the government was perceived as so corrupt. And that's the danger. That's the same problem we face in Iraq and in some of our other allies as well. They are either corrupt or they are increasingly autocratic. You look at where the United States has turned for help in Afghanistan, and it is the Gulf sheikdoms taking in or providing the United States access to its military bases. And these are not countries that are democratic or hold democratic elections. And the danger is, in the Middle East, we find many of our allies, as you mentioned earlier, Mubarak may be gone, but you have a former field marshal in Abdul Fattah el-Sisi in Egypt, that you find autocracies and monarchies now dominating, a far cry from the kind of mood we saw 10 years ago with the Arab Spring, as one after another dictator across the region began to fall. And the question is, so what do we do next? And not to ramble on, but I will say that we are a country with a lot of different tools, and whether it's using our economic aid to help countries create jobs, to foster civil society, which is the nascent building block of a democracy, there are a lot of other things we can do. And our tendency is too often to throw our military at a problem and think that will solve it, because it won't.
So let's conclude on a thought, looking back on your book 10 years ago, Rock the Casbah, which was to some degree hooked to the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and also at that time to the so-called Arab Spring, the youth-led uprisings for democracy against both dictators that were backed by the United States and other dictators, and it appeared for a time against the Islamists like Al-Qaeda at the same time. I think the the pro-Bush people argued that, look, it's working. The invasion of Iraq might have been horrible in many ways, and even based on false information about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But it had the side effect of unleashing what President Bush always said that it would, which was a hunger for democracy that would lead to popular uprisings that the United States didn't have to participate in. But here we are, almost all of those have been squelched. The horrible war in Syria, and as you mentioned before, so we had Mubarak in Egypt, a little bit of democracy, and now el-Sisi. So how do those two tie together with this now 10-year lens of history of how 9/11 and the U.S. response to 9/11 and the Arab Spring, at least an attempt at it, connect to each other?
The Arab Spring was, in many ways, a mass protest inspired by the death of a young fruit vendor who set himself on fire to protest corruption and injustice. It had nothing to do, or was not inspired at all, by the U.S. intervention in Iraq and the ouster of Saddam Hussein. This was a truly indigenous movement that swept the region. I think the original sin in many ways was that the United States didn't know how to help a lot of inexperienced young people figure out a different future. In Libya, we used particularly our war machine to put pressure on Muammar Gaddafi. And as soon as he was killed, we kind of walked away and allowed local militias that had formed in the intervening months to launch a civil war that, you know, is still not over a decade later. This is, again, where we throw military tools, and we could have used a lot of different ways to say no when el-Sisi engaged in a military coup against the first democratically elected government in the history of Egypt. That we have been timid about human rights, about standing up for the things we as a nation believe in. We, again, are reactive rather than proactive. We're not imaginative. We think that as a power, we use our foremost instruments of power to address problems. And, you know, we know how to fight wars. We don't know how to create the peace afterwards. And that's where we get in trouble time and time and time again.
And maybe with Afghanistan as example, we don't even know how to fight wars. Robin Wright from The New Yorker and the Wilson Center, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Always great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.